Lecture 14, Rigoletto, Conclusion and Il Trovatore.
We return to the life and operas of Verdi. This is Lecture 14, and it is entitled Rigoletto, Conclusion and Il Trovatore. We return to the heart-rending conclusion of Rigoletto, recapping the action of the final scene to this point. It is midnight. Sparafucile has delivered to Rigoletto a cloth bag containing a body. Rigoletto, convinced that it's the Duke of Mantua's freshly butchered corpse in the sack, has just sung a song of victory and jubilation. Look at me now, O world! I am a buffoon, and that was a prince. He lies beneath my feet. It's him! Oh, joy! At last my grief is avenged. Let the river be his grave, the sack his shroud. Into the water! Into the water! But of course, just as Rigoletto was about to roll the sack into the river, he heard the voice of the Duke back at the inn, singing his La Donna è mobile thing. Rigoletto's blood runs cold, and things had been going so nicely. So what have we got? For Rigoletto, bad news all the way around. It's about 5 minutes past midnight. His wallet is 20 crowns lighter. He's just heard the Duke singing from back at the inn, and he's standing over a burlap sack with a body in it, and he hasn't a clue as to whose body it is. But whoever it is, this cannot possibly be good. All of this rockets through Rigoletto's head in a microsecond as, having heard the Duke singing in the distance, he exclaims, Who, then, is in the sack? A good question, dude, but one you really don't want answered. Rigoletto pulls out a knife and cuts open the sack. Io tremo. I tremble. It's a human body. A sudden bolt of lightning flashes across the sky, illuminating the body. Rigoletto shrieks in terror. Mia figlia! My daughter! God! My daughter! No, it's impossible. She's on her way to Verona. I must be seeing things. Right on cue, another lightning bolt illuminates the body. Rigoletto falls to his knees and gasps. It is she! Oh, my Gilda! My child! Speak to me! Who did this? Who? Rigoletto stands and pounds desperately on the door of the inn. We hear the pounding in the orchestra accompaniment, but no one answers. No one! No one! My daughter! My Gilda! Oh, my daughter! As we might have expected, Gilda, despite having more puncture wounds in her torso than a pincushion at a quilting bee, is not quite dead. Weakly, she sings, Chi mi chiama? Who calls me? Rigoletto again falls to his knees and desperately sings. She speaks. She moves. She is alive. Oh, God, my only joy on earth. Look at me. It is your father. Gilda sings. Ah, padre mio, my father. Rigoletto is almost hysterical. He asks, What happened? Are you hurt? Speak to me. Painfully, Gilda, pointing to her heart, tells him, The blade struck. Here. Rigoletto does not understand. In a voice that embodies every iota of his body and soul, he asks, he demands of Gilda, Who struck you? We listen from Rigoletto's panic question, Chi am I? Who then is in the sack?
Chi am I? Chi è qui in favece? Io tremo. E umano corpo mia figlia io mia figlia ma no è impossibile per Verona in via fu vision e questa Oh, mia Gilda, fanciullo, a me rispondi, l'assassino mi suona. Ora, nessuno, nessuno, mia figlia, oh, mia figlia,
Rigoletto has just commanded with every ounce of his being that Gilda tell him who has done this to her. Haltingly, near her end, she answers, I deceived you. It is my fault. I loved him too much, and now I'll die for him. The horrible truth hits Rigoletto like a 200-pound sack of rigatoni. Stupefied, he sings, Terrible God! She was stabbed with the blade of my own vendetta, my own revenge. My angel, look at me, listen to me, speak to me, my darling daughter. Gilda speaks as descending strings illustrate her waning strength. Let me rest. Forgive me, forgive him. Benedite alla figlia, o mio padre. Bless your daughter, o father. We listen from the point where Gilda sings, Vo ignanato, I deceived you, it is my fault.
Tremendo, ella stessa fu colta dallo stral di mia giusta vendetta. Angelo caro mi guarda, m'ascolta, parla, parla. Figlioli letto,
io che lo taccio, a me, a lui perdonate, e mi dite alla figlia, o mio padre.
And now the demands of good theater must and will be met. Demand number one, that father and daughter will have one last parting duet before Gilda finally walks towards the light. Demand number two, that the opera's ending should contain within it a note of resolution and consolation, a sense that perhaps it's better this way, a theatric device dating back to the tragedies of ancient Greece. Apropos of demand number two, are Gilda's next words in which she talks about being reunited with her mother in heaven. She sings, Up in heaven, with my mother, I will pray for you in eternity. From here to the end of the opera, Gilda's voice will be accompanied by flute arpeggios and high strings, Verdi's essential orchestrational shtick for death scenes since I Lombardi, meant to indicate that the dying singer is headed for a higher, better place. And while the anticipation of her heavenly reunion with her mother might make Gilda feel a little better about things, it doesn't do much for Rigoletto, who is consumed with grief. On his knees, shaking, weeping, he begs his daughter, Do not die, my treasure! Have mercy, my dove! You cannot leave me. If you die, I'll be alone. Oh, let me die with you! The heavenly high strings resume as Gilda begins to drift off.
No more. Forgive him, my father. I will pray.
And Gilda dies. A brief but terrible moment of silence passes, and then from Rigoletto's throat, the death wail bursts forth.
Gilda, my Gilda, she is dead. Ah, la maledizione, the curse.
Tearing his hair, accompanied by explosive closing D-flat minor chords in the orchestra, Rigoletto falls across his daughter's corpse. Lights out, curtain down, and not a single dry eye in the house. Melodramatic? Oh, yeah. Tearjerker? Absolutely. Good, effective theater. The very best. Let's listen. Rigoletto postscript. 10 months before the premiere of Rigoletto, on May 8, 1850, Verdi wrote the second of a series of letters to Francesco Piave regarding a project that just could not fail. We quote Verdi, "Oh, Le Roi Samuse is the greatest subject and perhaps the greatest drama of modern times. Trublet is a creation worthy of Shakespeare. It's a subject that can't fail." Unquote. As usual, Verdi's dramatic instincts were right on the button. Trublet, renamed Rigoletto, is one of the most memorable characters in all opera, and the opera Rigoletto remains one of the most memorable and popular operas in the repertoire. Rigoletto was, for Verdi, what the Third Symphony, the Eroica, was for Beethoven. A watershed work, a landmark composition, a new path in terms of each composer's output. Verdi himself described Rigoletto as a revolutionary work. In Rigoletto, we hear a dramatic continuity greater than any Verdi had ever before achieved. There are very few conventional arias, and the use of parlante does away almost entirely with anything resembling recitative. So whether we consider Rigoletto to be the last of Verdi's early operas, the end of the beginning, as some writers call it, or the first of his fully mature operas, Rigoletto occupies a special place in both Verdi's output and in the history of opera in general. As for Verdi's contemporaries, his audience, they were less concerned with compositional technique, his use of parlante and operatic posterity, than they were concerned with a good show. And Rigoletto was a good show, a darned good show. It was a huge hit. The Venetian audiences loved it, and it ran for 13 consecutive performances at the Teatro La Fenice. The critics, well, they were another story. As we might expect for an opera based on such a controversial subject, the reviews ranged from the extremely positive to the extremely negative and everything in between. For example, on the plus side, the critic for Il Lombardo Veneto wrote, and we quote, "This is music of a truly new kind. It is an unbroken fabric of instrumentation, easy, flowing, spontaneous, which either speaks softly to your soul or awakens you to pity or horrifies you according to the development of the drama. I will have to hear it again to understand it thoroughly, but it is clearly a masterpiece," unquote. The conductor Angelo Mariani wrote in the Gazzetta Musicale di Milano, and we quote, "I do not hesitate at all to declare that this most recent Verdi work is his best as regards to novelty, knowledge, and musical beauty. I say this to the readers honestly. I have no words to express the wonder that such a noble work aroused in me. From my heart, I congratulate the man who wrote it, who is justifiably renowned," unquote. Many of the negative reviews singled out Piave for writing such an immoral libretto. For example, the critic for the Venice-based journal Il Vaglio attacked Piave for his immorality and bad taste, stating that, and we quote, "Piave wanted to make a copy of Hugo's Le Roi s'amuse and make a gift of it to the honorable house of the Dukes of Gonzaga, that is, the Duke of Mantua, by making their ancestor a new Don Giovanni." And despite Verdi's masterfully composed music, the opera will send the audience away from the theater empty and disgusted at such a horrendous and nauseating spectacle, unquote. Another critic described Hugo's Le Roi s'amuse as one of the, quote, "most grotesque abortions of French dramatic literature," unquote, and went on to describe Piave's libretto as, quote, "a real California, a real gold mine of transgressions filled with ugly images and clumsy lines," unquote. A comment written, we should take note, in 1851 during the California Gold Rush. Most of the critical comment towed a middle line, expressing great admiration for the music, but great discomfort with the libretto. We quote one such review, eloquently written as representative of many other like reviews. And again, we quote, "An opera like this cannot be judged in one night. Yesterday, we were overwhelmed by the novelty, or rather, the oddness of the subject. Novelty in the music, in the style, in the very form of the pieces. All in all, it is Victor Hugo's Le Roi s'amuse, pure and simple, with all its sins. The composer and the poet, seized with a late blooming love for satanic in art, are looking for beauty, in deformity, in horror. They are looking for effects, not in the usual areas of pity and terror, but in the soul's torment and destruction. We cannot, in good conscience, praise such taste." In spite of that, the opera was a complete success, and the composer was hailed, called out, acclaimed after almost every piece, and two numbers even had to be repeated. To tell the truth, the instrumentation is stupendous. The orchestra speaks to you, cries out to you. It instills passion in you. There was never such powerful eloquence in sound, unquote. Certainly, with Rigoletto, Verdi had taken another step forward in the eyes of the operatic world. He was no longer just a composer of popular, passionate, and entertaining operas. He was no longer just an Italian patriot whose operas mirrored and inspired the soul of his nation. He was now a composer whose incremental refinement of his art had taken him past what Italians had theretofore recognized as the limit of operatic expression. From Rigoletto onwards, Verdi's personal musical and dramatic evolution put him in a place of his own making, occupied only by himself. Within 4 years, Rigoletto had been performed across Europe, Asia Minor, North America, and South America. Rigoletto became the platform on which Giuseppe Verdi's international fame and reputation were built. Giuseppe and Giuseppina at home. Domestic crisis. With the completion of Rigoletto, Verdi had written 15 operas in 9 years. We would hope, for Verdi's sake at least, that his family would have provided an oasis of peace in the midst of his otherwise harried, pressure cooker life. That's our boy, the opera composer. And you'd think, we'd hope, that having Giuseppina Strepponi at his side helped alleviate the extraordinary stress Verdi experienced during the composition of Rigoletto. And to tell you the truth, given what was going on around him at home in late 1850 and early 1851, it's a miracle Verdi was able to compose Stifelio and Rigoletto at all. Let's recap the action leading up to what became the domestic crisis of January 1851, a crisis that occurred during the very same month Verdi had to compose the great bulk of Rigoletto under incredible deadline pressure. Giuseppina Strepponi moved into Verdi's house, the Palazzo Cavalli in central Busetto, in September of 1849. We know that she was treated very badly by the good people of Busetto, but at first, the treatment consisted of whispering about her behind her back and ignoring her to her face. For Giuseppina and for Verdi, the solitude that resulted from being ignored was almost a blessing. At first. But as time passed, the whispers got louder and louder and more degrading. Instead of getting used to having Giuseppina in their midst, the people of Busetto became ever more offended by her presence. And increasingly, the people who were most critical of Verdi, and they were very vocal about it, to Verdi's horror and disappointment, were his own parents, Carlo and Luigia Verdi. Carlo Verdi felt entitled to criticize his son. Over the years, in Giuseppe's absence, he had managed his son's increasingly large land holdings in the Busetto Leroncole area, and as patriarch of his family, he felt responsible to both his family and his community for the fact that his son had brought a tainted woman of low reputation, the mother of illegitimate children, a woman who displayed herself on stage in the theater, into their community to live among them. It all came to a head in January of 1851. The criticism, the prying, the attacks, the dirty looks, the endless nasty comments. Verdi couldn't do anything about the population of Busetto, but he could do something about his parents, and he did. He hired a lawyer named Ercolano Balestra to draw up a document of legal separation from his parents. He ordered his parents out of the farmhouse in which they were living in nearby Sant'Agata, so that he and Giuseppina could move there themselves. And move in they did, living there for the next 50 years. For years, for decades, Verdi kept enlarging, altering, and rebuilding the house. He was always changing and enlarging something, and he was every contractor's best dream. Verdi used to tell people that he loved the sound of hammering in the house. Giuseppina was not quite as enthusiastic about her husband's remodeling habit. In a letter to Clarina Maffei, Giuseppina wrote, quote, "Except for the kitchen, the cellar, and the stables, as a result of the endless construction, we have slept and eaten our meals in every nook of the house," unquote. But back, please, to the domestic crisis of 1851. Verdi's legal separation from and eviction of his parents did nothing to further endear him to his community. On the contrary, in a culture where a man's care for his parents was considered the ultimate measure of his character, Verdi's treatment of his parents was seen by the locals as yet another example of the poison, the curse, la maledizione, that Giuseppina Strepponi had brought with her to Busetto. Now, Verdi didn't help matters at all by refusing to say whether he and Giuseppina were married. Now, they didn't marry until 1859. 17 years after they met, at least 12 years after they became lovers, and 10 years after they moved in together in Busetto. Verdi's and Strepponi's unwillingness to discuss whether or not they were married is inexplicable. Their unwillingness to discuss it probably is attributable to the fact that they were both extremely independent and unconventional people who believed that it was nobody's damned business but their own. In early 1852, Antonio Barezzi wrote to Verdi, criticizing his lifestyle and asking him outright if he and Giuseppina were indeed married. Verdi's letter in response to Barezzi's is both a model of evasion as well as an unequivocal demand that Giuseppina Strepponi be respected for who she was as a person, married or not. We quote in part Verdi's letter back to Barezzi. Quote, "Dearest father-in-law, I did not expect to get such a cold letter from you. If your letter were not signed, Antonio Barezzi, my benefactor, I would have answered very sharply, or I would not have answered at all. You live in a town that has the bad habit of getting mixed up in other people's business and of disapproving of everything that does not conform to its ideas. It is my habit not to get mixed up in others' affairs precisely because I demand that no one meddle in mine. From this comes the gossip, the complaints, and the disapproval. Freedom of action is certainly my right to demand, even by my own town. You be the judge, and be a severe but cool and objective judge. What is bad about my living in isolation? If I prefer not to pay calls on titled people? If I choose not to share in the festivities of others? I repeat, what is bad about this? In any case, no one is damaged by it. But now, to the larger point. In my house, there lives a free and independent lady, a lover, like me, of the solitary life. Neither she nor I owe any explanation for our actions to anyone at all. What rights do I have over her, and she over me? Who knows whether she is or is not my wife? And if she were, who knows what particular motives, what reasons we have for not making that public? Who knows whether it is good or bad? Why could it not also be good? And even if it were a bad thing, who has the right to damn us? I will say that in my house, people owe to her the same respect owed to me, or even greater respect. And she has every right to this respect because of her behavior, her spirit, and because of the kindness she never fails to show for others. The point of this long letter is to say that I demand my freedom of action, and that you, who are basically so good, so just, and have such a good heart, should not let yourself be influenced by others in a town that did not find me worthy to be its organist and now complains against my actions and my own business. In this letter, nothing should offend you, but if by chance something should offend you, then I swear to you on my honor that I have no intention of giving you any kind of unhappiness. I have always and do now still consider you my benefactor, and I am honored by that, and I boast of it. Addio, addio, with all my usual friendship, Giuseppe Verdi." Unquote. In regards to whether he and Giuseppina were married, Verdi never did answer Barezzi's question. And Antonio Barezzi, bless him once again, was too smart to push the issue. He accepted Giuseppe Verdi and Giuseppina Strepponi for who they were and remained, along with Francesco Piave and Emanuele Muzio, their closest friend, one of the very few people in the world who was always welcome in their house. Il Trovatore and maturity. Incredible as it may seem, at the time he wrote the just-quoted letter to Antonio Barezzi, Verdi was still only 38 years old, and despite the domestic distractions, 1852 was a special year in a creative life not lacking in special years. Almost simultaneously, he composed two of his most popular and important operas, Il Trovatore and La Traviata. We will begin our discussion of Il Trovatore now and complete it, along with an all-too-brief examination of La Traviata, in Lecture 15. Il Trovatore and La Traviata are popular because they are compelling musical dramas with fascinating characters, and each boasts enough great and memorable music to fill several albums. They are important because, along with Rigoletto, they represent a new plateau in Verdi's compositional career, a maturity that put him forever and a day beyond the rest of the field. As we have discussed, Verdi's maturation was about creating ever greater dramatic momentum and expressive oomph, about doing away with the momentum-killing distinctions between recitative, aria, and ensemble, about his increasing use of parlante, about his spectacular use of the orchestra as an integral part of the drama, and so forth. But there's another element we must now discuss, if ever so briefly, because it lies at the very heart of Verdi's maturing art. That element was the nature of the Italian language poetry from which Verdi slowly began to disassociate himself. We'll say that again because it is the key to understanding Giuseppe Verdi's maturing operatic art. Slowly but surely, he began to disassociate himself from the essential nature of Italian language poetry. Yes, yes, this might seem like a contradiction. Verdi's operas are what they are. They were possible because of the perfect balance of consonant and vowel that is the Italian language. But that perfect balance of consonant and vowel manifests itself in Italian language poetry as an almost unavoidable metric regularity, a regularity that came to be viewed as not necessarily a good thing. You see, the metric regularity of Italian poetry became, in time, a straitjacket for the poets who wrote Italian language libretti, poets who were still writing and using rhyme schemes that had dated back hundreds of years. The problem was given perfect voice by Giovanni Pacini, who was born in 1796 and died in 1867, a highly respected composer of Italian operas and a contemporary of Rossini. In his memoirs, Pacini wrote, and we quote, "Our sweet-sounding language, and in consequence our poetry, ruled as it is by rhythm and uniformity of verse, are the principal factors in our musical phrase construction. The German and English people will never be able to overtake us because of the roughness of their tongue, nor will the French, due to the irregularity of their verse, the poverty of their vocabulary, their diphthongs, and finally because certain of their letters produce nasal sounds. Nevertheless, the Italian composer of today must do everything he can to escape from the straitjacket imposed by the natural uniformity and regularity of our Italian poetry." Unquote. There's that word, straitjacket, again. Certainly Verdi came to feel that way about the nature of much Italian language poetry, and he dealt with the issue in two ways. First, he demanded and got from his librettists ever more prose-like texts and freer, less rigid rhyme schemes. Second, he cultivated in his music irregular phrase structures and accent patterns that de-emphasized the regularity of the poetry he was setting to music. And in doing so, he created a much more fluid and continuous musical line, one generally unhindered by the predictable phrases and accents of the poetry itself. These are subtle aspects of Verdi's art, aspects that he chose to exercise whenever he felt the dramatic need. It is a testament to both his craft and good taste that he could deliver incredibly memorable tunes and the expressive dramatic goods whenever he needed to. Case in point, Il Trovatore, Act 2, Scene 1. We need not know anything of the story except that it is dawn, and a gypsy encampment is coming to life as the sun slowly rises and the stage slowly brightens. For this act-beginning gypsy episode, Verdi must create music that is appropriately exotic in sound and descriptive of their activities, activities that are dominated by blacksmithing. After a brief, chattering, rustic orchestral introduction that features the triangle, which appropriately evokes the music of the East, a chorus of male gypsies greets the day with a poetic strophe in a A-B-A-B-C-C rhyme scheme, a very regular rhyme scheme. I read it in Italian. Vedi le fosche notturne spoglie dei cieli sveste l'immensa volta. Sembra una vedova che alfin si toglie i bruni panni ondera in volta. All'opera, all'opera, dagli martella. In translation, see, the sky casts off her dark nightly clothing like a widow who finally puts away her black veil of mourning. To work! Strike my hammer! The men then pick up their hammers and alternate blows on the anvils on stage, the basses on the strong beats and the tenors strike on the weak beats. They continue to sing in time with their hammer blows, and they sing, first in Italian, Chi del gitano I giorni a bella? La zingarella! What makes the life of every gypsy worthwhile? La zingarella! The gypsy maiden, of course. Now, in this brief and extremely famous passage, Verdi sets the words with utter clarity and great verve without ever falling into the trap of being restricted, that is, musically straitjacketed, by the text's rhyme schemes. He manages to deliver tunefulness and memorability, but on his own terms. And at the same time, he drives the dramatic action forward with music that is flexible and utterly lacking in any sense of formula or predictability. Let's listen. Il Trovatore, Act 2, Introduction and Opening Chorus. Now, who doesn't find this music dramatically appropriate and melodically engaging, varied and accessible, and yet not predictable? Well, exactly! It is just another example of sprezzatura, effortless mastery on the surface, extraordinary craft and imagination below the surface. It is Verdi's compositional maturity in full bloom. Il Trovatore, the plot. Many authorities consider the libretto of Il Trovatore, or The Troubadour, to be the most bizarre in the standing operatic repertoire. Huh! An opera with a strange and bizarre plot. How unusual. Listen, compared to the stories of many Baroque-era opera serie, Il Trovatore is a standard little yarn about murder and passion, hatred and love, jealousy and vengeance. What makes Il Trovatore work, what makes it so special, is, of course, Verdi's musical setting, a setting that magnifies and intensifies the already over-the-top melodramatic emotional content of the libretto to a point where, at its premiere in Rome, on January 19th of 1853, several women fainted and a number of men and women were so overcome with emotion that they had to leave the theater. Il Trovatore is yet another example of Verdi's taste in literature and his sense of what for him made great dramatic theater. The contrast and the conflict of the most powerful emotions, highly charged dramatic situations, and characters whose flaws and passions never stop pushing the drama forward. From the point of view of magnified emotional content, the mature Verdi was a quintessential Romantic era artist, reveling, as he did, in stories that plumbed and exposed the deepest and darkest recesses of the human heart and soul. Verdi's maturing operas, starting with Macbeth and Louisa Miller, can be considered expressionistic works in that their motivating element, that dramatic element that pushes them forward and gives them their dramatic focus, is the inner lives of their principal characters and how those inner lives manifest themselves in the relationships between the characters. Verdi wrote 28 operas, with the exception of the second, the disastrous Un Giorno di Regno, King for a Day, and the last, Falstaff. They are all opere serie, serious and, more often than not, tragic operas. It is a fascinating fact that Verdi did not reveal his extraordinary comic touch until the very end of his career in an opera completed when he was 80 years old. Perhaps by then, his own rage and frustration, which were the underlying inspiration for so many of his earlier operas, had finally dissipated to the point that he could finally be a bit of a clown. Better late than never, we suppose. But back to Il Trovatore. With the premiere of Rigoletto behind him, Verdi turned to a project he'd been considering for at least a year, an operatic setting of the Spanish playwright Antonio García Gutiérrez's El Trovador. Gutiérrez, by the way, was an exact contemporary of Verdi's, having been born, like Verdi, in 1813. His best-known play, El Trovador, was staged in 1836. Verdi would turn to Gutiérrez again in 1857 when he set his play Simón Bocanegra into the opera Simon Bocanegra. To prepare what he knew would be a very difficult libretto, Verdi turned to the Naples-based librettist Salvatore Camerano. Camerano had written the libretti for Verdi's Alzira, La Battaglia di Legnano, an opera we have not discussed, which was premiered in 1849, and Luisa Miller. Camerano wrote libretti for many other composers, the best known of which are Donizetti's Lucia di Lammermoor and Roberto Devereux. Verdi respected Camerano's stagecraft tremendously and preferred his work to that of Francesco Piave. However, Camerano was a notorious flake who only worked when the urge, or the monetary need, struck him. His eccentricities notwithstanding, Verdi needed Camerano for the Trovatore gig, as Verdi had also originally wanted him for Rigoletto, a job Camerano, fearing both censors and deadlines, had turned down. Now, for himself, Verdi knew that the story of El Trovador, Il Trovatore, was over the top, and he said so much in a letter to Camerano. Quote, "You won't mind if I take the liberty of saying to you that if we cannot make our opera as bizarre as the play, we'd better give up now," unquote. Camerano agreed, and Verdi hired him to write the libretto. Having done so, Verdi began to fret almost immediately. A month later, furious that Camerano was already dragging his heels, Verdi wrote to their mutual friend, the Neapolitan Cesare De Sanctis. Verdi wrote, and we quote, "Well, does he like it, Il Trovatore, or not? He thinks nothing about time, which is extremely precious to me," unquote. A few weeks later, Verdi wrote directly to Camerano in response to a letter Camerano had written to Verdi. Verdi fired back, and we quote, "Yes, yes, it is true that I don't have a noose around my neck, and thus, in theory, there is no hurry. Nevertheless, I do want to get the opera off the ground," unquote. 6 months later, in October, Verdi was reduced to begging. He wrote Camerano, quote, "I beg you with all my soul to please finish this Trovatore as quickly as you possibly can," unquote. Providing the censors approved the libretto, the premiere was scheduled to take place in January 1853 at Rome's Teatro Apollo. Finally, in early 1852, the libretto started to appear in dribs and drabs at Verdi's door. First came the first act. A couple of months later, the second act. Bits and pieces of the third act, an outline for the fourth and final act. Verdi was thrilled with what he read. On May 3rd, 1852, he again wrote Cesare De Sanctis, and we quote, "Ask him, that is, ask Camerano, to send me the rest of the libretto as quickly as possible, and tell him that when this is finished, if he wants to do another for me, I would be blissfully happy," unquote. Well, that was not to be. While anxiously awaiting the remainder of the libretto, Verdi was leafing through a theatrical paper in late July when he read of Camerano's death on July 17th. He was stunned. He immediately wrote Cesare De Sanctis in Naples, quote, "A bolt of lightning! It's impossible to describe to you my deep sorrow over this. I read of his death not in a letter, but in a stupid theatrical journal. You who loved him as much as I, you will understand all the things I cannot bear to say to you. Poor Camerano! What a loss! We must not change, even in the smallest way, the creation of our poor friend, whose memory I, first of all, wish to have respected, unquote. Though Camerano never finished the libretto, Verdi sent his widow full payment for it, plus a generous bonus to help her and her six children through the difficult time following his death. As for the unfinished libretto, it was skillfully completed by another Neapolitan writer named Emanuele Bardare. When we return, the story of Il Trovatore and some more music. Thank you.